Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Thursday morning. And it's very nice to have you with us. It's the 10th day of April, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. A lot going on. Well, it's been tumultuous over the last 24 hours. And so we'll dig in and make the best of this. And meaning we'll try to get to as many topics as we possibly can and try to make sense of whatever we can make sense of. We welcome you and we hope that you can be a part of the program. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We are going to go to 11 o'clock this morning, so you have a little more time built in. We have built in a little more time to take some more letters. We ask that you make them brief, to the point, and then that way we can get to as many as possible.
And complimentary.
Well, that's right.
No acronyms. Remember that?
You're absolutely right. Yes. Links, we don't want. Yes. No. That's exactly what. You're right. Yeah. I'm sure everyone will abide by these rules and we'll be fine. panel@wamc.org. Now, let's go to the introductory phase of the morning where I tell you who is on the program, and we have quite a group this morning. Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia DeMontes here. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. I will do my best to try to make sense of this with my fellow panelists here, but no promises.
Yeah, we're all just...
I think that's an important part of the introduction. We can't promise to...
Going as... just dancing as fast as we can. Yeah. That's about all you can do. Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld is in the house. How are you, Ira?
I'm okay so far, but it's very early in the morning. So.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
But it's nice to be here.
We love when you're here. It makes the day much more pleasant.
You're the one.
Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, is here as well. Good morning, Judy. How are you?
I am good. That was a real barn burner of a show you had yesterday.
We had a show yesterday, and we had Rich Honan on, so, you know, stir, mix, and enjoy. But we had some good commentary, and some people loved it, and some people didn't,
I had an obligation, so I had to break away, but I was able to download it later in the afternoon on WAMC.org and listen to the whole
thing.
Hear
what you missed. You know what I found interesting about this program? I told a little tale out of school, but both two of the panelists, I won't even identify which two, but two of the panelists told me that they had to leave early. And they said, somewhere between 9:30 and 10, we have to leave. And we got to that point, and I said to both of them, are you leaving? And they said, oh, no, we're not leaving this. And everybody just cleared their schedule and just kept on going. And I thought, well, that's good. They're in. So it worked out very well. But if you missed it, Judy's absolutely right. You can listen to it online, wamc.org/roundtable, and you can hear any show in the past. And maybe even this one. Maybe you'll want to listen to this one again. Let's go to what is happening in the world. And again, we welcome you, panel@wamc.org.
Can you tell us what music we were listening to? Because I was really enjoying that blues.
That was Freddie King. Freddie King, and the playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. So,
thanks.
Yes, the great, great Freddie King.
I never was able to determine, didn't look it up, whether Freddie King and Albert King and B.B. King were related. B.B. King is one of my all-time favorites. I used to think when people say they can recognize artists by the instruments, and I said, well, how can you recognize it? But I can tell B.B. King or Leon Russell, another of my favorites, a piano player, they have a style that's unmistakable.
So there was Albert King, B.B. King, and Freddie King, none of whom blood relatives.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Unlike the King Sisters, though, that's a whole other.
getting into a whole other thing. But they considered those three gentlemen, Albert, B.B., and Freddie, to be the three kings of the blues guitar, although they were not related. So, little history lesson for us all. But passed away in 1976. So been
Freddie died that long ago.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, quite a while. So. Good music that we'll be listening to this morning. Okay, let's get to the meat of the program and to find out where we are here. So for those of you who left, were with us till the end of the show yesterday, there were still tariffs in place, and they had only been in place for about less than 12 hours, I think 8 hours or so. When we left the airwaves, and maybe 10 hours. And then we were talking about how these were going to continue, and we had a conversation about how there was going to be no negotiation. They were not going to negotiate that. These were going to be for the long haul. We were going to see what happened. Then on yesterday afternoon, mid-afternoon, the president reversed course on global tariffs and announced a 90-day pause. So the 10% tariffs that went in place earlier yesterday were then put on pause for 90 days, with the exception of China. And just hours after he put those levies into place on nearly 60 countries, the announcement came out that there would be a pause for 90 days. Mr. Trump did not extend that pause to China, opting instead to raise tariffs again on all Chinese imports, bringing those taxes to a whopping 125%. That decision came after Beijing raised its levies on American goods to 84% on Wednesday afternoon in an escalating tit-for-tat between the world's largest economies. In a post on Truth Social, the president said he had authorized a 90-day pause, shouty caps, all capitalized, P-A-U-S-E, pause, in which countries would face a substantially lowered reciprocal tariff of 10%. As a result, nearly every U.S. trading partner now faces a 10% blanket tariff on top of 25% tariffs that Mr. Trump has imposed on cars, steel, and aluminum. Slumping markets quickly rallied after Mr. Trump's post. The S&P 500 climbed several percentage points in just a matter of minutes and closed with a rise of more than 9%, sharply reversing days and days of losses. Wednesday was the best day for the S&P 500 since the recovery from the 2008 financial crisis. Nearly every stock in the index rose, airlines, some tech companies, even Tesla were among those companies to soar over 20%. Shares of automakers rose sharply, even though 25% tariffs on imported cars remain in place. Ford and General Motors both rose more than 7%. Mr. Trump, who for days had insisted he was not concerned about the market rout, acknowledged on Wednesday that the downturn had led into the decision. Here's the quote. "Over the last few days, it looked pretty glum," Mr. Trump said. "I thought the people were jumping a little bit out of line," he said in explaining his decision. "They were getting yippy.
Yippy.
They were getting a little bit afraid. You know, yippy."
All right. So he went to the Wharton School to learn that.
Mr. Trump's change in course came amid a sharp sell-off in U.S. government bond markets and the dollar, which are typically seen as the safest corner for investors during times of turmoil. Investors large and small had watched trillions in stock market value vanish in just a matter of days. Asked Wednesday if the bond market reaction had caught his attention, Mr. Trump said he noticed over the weekend that investors were getting queasy. That from the New York Times. Now to our panel. Would you like to start off, Judy?
So 3.5 years to go. You know, oh no, more than 3.5 years to go. So I tend to look at I'm an observer of spin and how the news covers things. And it's been interesting to watch people, you know, contort themselves like pretzels to try to explain this mass tariff imposition that he announced a week ago on Liberation Day. And then to watch as he flip-flopped on it, and then to watch, I mean, for Fox News, for example, really hasn't been covering the last week of stock market turmoil. They've been focused on crazy stuff, you know, that really no mention. You can hear it on some of the late night programs, but even today they're still not focusing on it. And I want to make the point that, like, it's interesting when it comes to spin. We talked about the stock market having a great day yesterday. Well, they still took my $10 investment. They drew it down to $6, and now it's back up to $8, and I'm supposed to be happy. I mean, there are still tariffs out there that need to be discussed. And also, this is only a 90-day pause, so it leaves the uncertainty everywhere. There's so much news to cover on this front. You need to explain what tariffs are. I mean, I don't think the bond market has ever gotten this much attention. People explaining how bonds work. So I think we just need to take everything with a grain of salt. And I think if anything, it reinforces the fact that you really can't trust that this administration knows what it's doing, because Trump himself said yesterday it's kind of a gut thing when he decides what to do. I'd love to see his college transcripts from Wharton to see how he actually did. I imagine all his professors have passed by now since he's an older man, but we've never really known how he did in that famous business school down in New Jersey.
Well, don't get too comfortable about yesterday's increase in the stock market, because it's already giving back a huge amount this morning. So on the futures, or Dow futures, were down about 500 a few minutes ago. So, yeah, he wants to get yippy. He doesn't want to get jiggy. That's Will Smith. That's another one. I tell you what.
Nice, Ira. Very good.
What really bothered me, there's so many things, as Judy says, to so many different angles you can go at, but one of the things that really bothered me about this is the uninformed sense of where they're coming from, they meaning Trump, as it relates to what this reaction would be among people who are losing money. In other words, he and the billionaire class can get by with a few days of the stock market going way down and a few months of uncertainty. Most people in this country, particularly those who have 401ks, can't. This is their life. This is their retirement. And I just don't get the sense that there's a connect there between Trump and whoever is advising him, and that group of people who they can't relate to. I mean, there's just no. There's no kinship between the White House and the public, it appears to me.
Well, and that kinship comes from, I would assume, how do I say this? If you had a solid plan and you knew what you were doing, and I just don't know if that exists.
Yeah, well,
right?
You know, to Judy's point about him and his grades and his professors, he doesn't have a sterling history of being a good businessman. His admonitions to the contrary, but... you know, the casino is always topic A. How could you lose money running
right.
a casino? And he managed to do that and take five or six other bankruptcies too.
Malia,
the most excellent bankruptcies.
Yeah, they're
the
actually
most outstanding.
A big beautiful bill. That's
yeah.
another one.
Yeah.
I feel
it's a beautiful word bankruptcy.
Yeah. It's almost as if he set fire to a house and then wants to be congratulated for calling the fire department. But the house is still burned, even though the fire department managed to save, you know, and also I feel like the rest of the world is starting to feel a little bit of the sort of whiplash that we in the United States have felt over, it's only been a couple months now. So let me talk a little bit about China in particular, or did you want to save that for?
No,
next?
Go ahead.
Okay.
No.
So, because everything has been more or less reversed except for China, which the tariffs have actually been increased, so they're over 100% now. I go to China every year. I studied Chinese in college. I've been traveling there for 30 years. And it was interesting. Last year when I was in China, I met a businessman who is based out of a relatively prosperous eastern coastal city. And he owned a series of factories throughout China. And this was in June. And he was planning, he had a plan at that point. He knew that if Trump were elected, that Trump would probably bring in even more tariffs. So he had a plan. How is he going to survive the potential of Trump tariffs? He's going to move all of his factories from China to other countries in Southeast Asia. And once Trump was elected, he immediately did that. And almost a dozen factories just moved out of China to Vietnam, Malaysia, and Thailand, I believe. And so it's just an example of how, you know, in China there are lots of rich people too, and they can move in ways that they can avoid the pain of these tariffs as well. So tariffs on both sides of the ocean, this has been said many times before, they tend to affect the most vulnerable. I'm sure this businessman was kicking himself yesterday though, because Vietnam originally was on the list of countries that was going to receive, you know, huge tariffs, and he had moved a bunch of his factories there. Just to remind folks that during the first Trump administration, Trump started what was then called a trade war with China and imposed a bunch of tariffs. And at the end of the Trump administration, there was already a sort of a 20% tariff on Chinese goods across the board. And Biden kept that in place and actually added a few more to that. So it's not like we were starting from zero, but there are a number of reasons, I think, that China has been a particular target, and some of them are connected to the market and others aren't. China continues to be the major supplier of fentanyl to the United States, and so opioid busts. I mean, there's a lot of data that shows this fentanyl flow from China. I find it astonishing, though, the different Trump administration approaches to fentanyl as a problem in international affairs, that putting a lot of tariffs on China is how he's handling it in the one hand. And then for a tiny, 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 tiny amount of fentanyl that was found crossing the border from Canada, he was joking about annexing Canada. It's a very inconsistent,
right,
to put it mildly, approach. Oh, sorry, we're blowing.
No, we're
past
going.
The,
you're okay.
Okay.
No, I didn't want to.
Going past the break again.
I just texted and said, Malia's on a roll.
Oh.
We're gonna hold off.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So that's part of it. The Congress during the first Trump administration held hearings about the fentanyl problem with China. And there has been a little bit of improvement. Ironically, there was no law enforcement cooperation between the U.S. and China on this subject, even though opioid deaths, it's a leading cause of death in the United States. There was no law enforcement cooperation until the Biden administration. And now, because of these tariffs, that kind of law enforcement cooperation is probably dead in the water, even though the problem of fentanyl is one of the reasons these tariffs are put in place. So it just makes it less likely they're going to solve the problem that is supposedly impelling these tariffs. I think another reason that the Trump is putting them in place, honestly, is a little bit of jealousy of Xi Jinping, who is the kind of autocratic strongman that Trump seems to admire. And even though Xi Jinping is presiding over a Chinese economy that is not in a really strong state right now, I think Trump looks at the growth in military, the consolidation of power by the Chinese Communist Party over the past couple of years as something that is admirable lost
the microphone
for a second.
Has dropped
yeah,
there. I'm sorry.
Is something that he's interested in emulating.
You know, I can only speak for myself, and then certainly not for the nation at large, but it just seems to me that there'd be a lot more confidence among the public in what Trump is doing if Trump had a better history as a businessman. And I mean, he, as I said before, he's got his businesses are littered with failures, and the kind of issues that are on play here and the amount of money that's in play here, who'd want to give him the opportunity to steer this ship?
I don't disagree with you one bit, but even if you don't go back and look at his history as a businessman, just over the last 4, 6, 8 weeks, the seesawing, the back and the forth, the back and the forth, the back and the forth, we're going to do this, we're not going to do this, we're going to do this, we're not going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, the court says no, we're going to do that. So that, I think, is really difficult for, I'm going to say, most of us to completely understand. And I mean, one of the stories that we're talking about, and you touched on it, of course, is that China becomes an alternative because they're not doing that. They have a much more firm hand, firm and steady hand on the wheel. So it does seem like it has the big question that's being asked this morning and was being asked last night is, what is the long-term effect of what happened over the last week? And I don't think we'll know because go ahead.
Well, there are some trends that have already been started. So, as I said, some of these tariffs have already been in place. And so that has the fact that they've ramped up so suddenly, it's just an extreme aspect of something that was already started a while ago. And as a result of these tariffs being in place, the percentage, the market percentage of Chinese exports going to the United States has lowered, and instead they've been really strengthening their trade relationships with the countries, especially in East Asia and Southeast Asia, taking a much greater share of Chinese exports. And this is a region where the United States has wanted to expand its influence, partly because China's been making some really aggressive military moves in the region. And so to help maintain peace and stability, I mean, that is something that has been a priority of multiple U.S. administrations, back of at least a decade. This idea of rebalancing to the Asia-Pacific or pivoting to the Asia-Pacific, that has been a key foreign policy goal that's been more or less consistent across the United States. So this tariff, this extreme tariff, is undermining that to a certain extent, because it's going to strengthen those trade bonds, and it's hard for countries to make a choice between a strong economic relationship if they have very close trade ties with China and a lot of their economy is tied to that, and then having a security relationship with the United States where the trade relationship isn't as strong.
It's the uncertainty that's such an issue now, because the ill will against America is pervasive around the world. And people going to negotiate with the United States, any country that goes, knows that they have to deal directly with Donald Trump. They can't go to the trade representative because apparently he didn't even know this was going to happen. He was out of the loop. Peter Navarro was out of the loop. I mean, they can't trust what they hear from the U.S. government because Donald Trump tends to act erratically, it seems. And going forward, I mean, people are just not going to trust us. And maybe this only lasts 4 years and we go back to some stability after the Trump administration. But the world can't trust that. And when it comes to building manufacturing plants, I mean, those are long-term commitments. And manufacturers around the world are trying to figure out how to proceed and what they can lock in so they can really make business plans.
The other thing, too, and well, this will be the last point before we go to a break, but it's the idea of, because we have heard for so long and in different circumstances that when you have a 90-day pause, and we saw this with TikTok, we've seen this on other things, and then it doesn't really seem to mean anything. It's forgotten. I mean,
well, that's what he used to do that all every time he would have a somebody would ask him, "Where's your hand? Where's your plan?" It'll be about 2 weeks.
Two weeks. That's right.
That was the number. That was 90 days.
Infrastructure day, healthcare, all of that. Right.
Taxes.
Exactly. So it's hard to know what, if anything, 90 days means, and what we're expecting from that 90 days. Again, you said the great uncertainty, Judy, and I agree with you. So over the next 90 days, is that when the negotiating that they said was never going to happen, or at least half the people said wasn't going to happen within the administration and the other half said would happen, that will happen now? Or is it we go back to this where it's just everything stops and we have the week that we had again. But which seems to me, I will say, not that I'm putting any money on this, but which seems very unlikely to me.
I think 90 days in the Trump administration, or at least it's such a long time period for him. He's not a long-term planner, to put it mildly, and so it could be 90 days. It could be, you know, eternity. There really isn't a difference between that. So he's just saying it indefinite pause. If he doesn't get, but I think he knows that other people pay attention and take his words more seriously than maybe he does himself. So he's put out this sort of deadline, which I don't think really makes that much of a difference to him. But he can bring it up at any point in the future if he feels like he hasn't made enough headway. But he'll just as likely to just forget it or say something else when, I mean, let's keep in mind, we haven't even been in a Trump administration for 90 days yet, right?
Right.
So
just under.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's it's
hard to think of what right. of what that's going to be.
Yeah.
Right. And so I mean we also hear this about spending plans and CRs and so forth, and we're just going to kick it down the road. We kick it down the road and then what actually do we do, and is there anything, you know, the idea being you put it on pause, you roll up your sleeves and you figure out, okay, what we're going to do. That doesn't seem to be the case here, but we'll see what happens.
And also, let's just state the obvious as well. This is no way to conduct long-term government planning. I mean, it's not just in the United States, but other governments now are sort of, you know, hanging their decision-making is hanging in the balance because the United States is such an important trading partner. And even though goodwill towards America or Americans may have dissolved somewhat, the fact remains the United States is still the biggest economy. And so people, governments, companies are going to want to figure this out.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Malia Dumont, Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick. Making up the panel this morning, we welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome you, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Let's go to some panel letters. Listening live, and I heard you state that all the tariffs are on pause with the exception of China. This is not true. The 10% universal tariff on the world is still in effect. Well, we mentioned that, but that's okay. The tariffs that were put on pause were the retaliatory, the reciprocal tariffs.
And the car tariff is
correct.
On.
Yes. I thought we made that clear, but if we did not, thank you very much for the tap on the shoulder. Also, interestingly, the EU has retaliated. So this will mean, will this mean that he'll punch back? And that is a question that is left out into the open.
That's his history, though, right? That's what he does. He punches back.
Rob says these tariffs were nothing more than a money grab. Trump manipulated the market so that his cronies could buy at the bottom of the market, knowing full well that they wouldn't be paused quickly. He even posted moments before the pause on Truth Social that it was a great day to buy stocks. Any of us would be arrested for such actions.
So Adam Schiff has already called for an investigation of that, the new senator from California. I mean, that everyone was suspicious of that from the get-go. I mean, this is going to be easy enough to determine if the Securities and Exchange Commission cooperates and does a full-throated investigation. We'll see.
Richard brings up an interesting point, and one that I think we should talk about a bit, which is that there will be no stability in the world economy until Congress takes back control of tariffs. God knows there is no more stabilizing force in the world than the U.S. Congress. But I understand Richard's point, because this is fundamentally their job and a key part of their job, and why this is being stripped from them and why it cannot be returned to them is still somewhat of a mystery.
Because they've acquiesced.
Yes.
You know, where there was a movement for them to take this back, and it had some momentum, but I think that the air went out of that balloon yesterday with this pause. It's still out there, but it makes total sense. It's right in the Constitution that they're supposed to do this. This is their job. So, but I imagine it's not going to go anywhere at this point.
Well, it's only, you know, it's 3.5 years left of Trump's term, but it's only 1.5 years of the current Congress and a significant number of senators. And there's a light at the end of the tunnel, although it's still 1.5 years, a lot can happen. But I think I don't think Trump is saying to himself, to the extent that he looked past tomorrow, that I've got 3.5 years to do what I want to do. But I think he realizes he's only got 1.5 years and then he may not have control anymore.
Good point. Let's go to this letter from Nancy. The tariff thing is all a game for Trump to, one, get the other countries to kiss his butt, and two, more importantly, to allow his billionaires to buy up stocks cheaply and sell them when he changes his mind and the stocks go up. Another bonus for his rich friends. I just want to ask a question. This brings something to mind, but there are certain, let's say, left news outlets who keep saying when the tariffs were reversed that trillions of dollars was erased, trillions of dollars went away, trillions of dollars went up in smoke. But as the market went up yesterday and went up and up and up and up, then that came back, right? I mean, it's not accurate to then say that we still are at a loss when a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it came back.
Right. You don't lose until you sell.
And if
you
That's say, right.
So it's just paper. It's paper gains and paper losses at this point.
But it's a way to keep score. It's, you know, people who recognize will understand. They may not understand what a stock or a bond is, but they'll understand when they look at their own accounts and thousands of dollars are not there that were there.
That's right. Yeah.
It's very real for people who are of retirement age and who are trying to make plans or are living on that. If they suddenly are getting less money, I mean, that's real.
This is to a point that was made a moment ago, but I'll allow. Sally says, listen to an MSNBC video suggesting that there most likely was some insider trading going on in and around the White House. What are the thoughts of the panelists?
You know, it crossed my mind yesterday morning that it would be a good day to buy a stock because they were on sale. I mean, that's what you buy low, sell high. But in my head, I'm thinking, well, that's a risk because people were talking about an increased chance of recession. We didn't know what would happen with the stock market. The only way to really comfortably buy a stock when it's low is if you know that it's going to go back
up. We don't know what the bottom is right now.
Right. And so, real investors wouldn't have known that. Only if you have inside information would you have been able to, you know, capitalize on what was happening. And the best financial advisors out there the last week have been telling everyone, don't do anything rash, hold the course. You know, let's see what's going to happen. Don't do anything rash.
this, and of course, everybody, I think most people knew at any time that this could be reversed, right? I mean, that was.
We didn't know what could happen. I mean, it was, you know, listening to people who support what was happening, the idea was to bring manufacturing back to the United States, or was it to increase revenue through tariffs so we could lower taxes? I really was never sure.
Fentanyl.
Yeah, immigration. I mean, in a different time, the president would do a speech where he laid out the economic plan and the strategy, but we really haven't gotten that. And like, I don't really know what the strategy is. Do we really want, as one of Trump's advisors says, do we want to bring back iPhone assembling to the U.S. where we're all going to be screwing in little screws?
Letnik said it's not the actual screwing, as it were, but it was the taking care of the robots that did the screwing.
Well, Kara Swisher said last night on one of the networks.
Just to make that completely clear and to keep our license. Go ahead.
No, well, Kara Swisher, who's the go-to guest for tech commentary, and knows Apple very well, says there's no way that they're going to move Apple phone manufacturing to the U.S. It's just definitely not going to happen. That Apple will make investments in the U.S. and have designs on doing other things, but building iPhones is not going to be one of them.
But to add to the confusion, you have Letnik and you have Navarro who are out there saying, we're not going to negotiate it, we're not going to negotiate, we're not going to negotiate, we're not going to negotiate. Then you have the president on the plane who said, we're looking to negotiate. And they go, they're saying they're not negotiating. We'll see what happens. He goes, and then, this is my favorite, both could be true. Okay. And so yes and no. All right, got it. And then you have it was the Treasury Secretary, right, who was on the Hill yesterday, and didn't even know at this point that there was a pause until he was told during the hearing.
Well, that was the trade rep.
The trade rep.
Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, was on several of the Sunday shows and people seem to still respect him, even though he's part of the administration. And he was also, in retrospect, was not up to speed on what was going to happen within the next 24 hours.
I think it's the difference between goals and strategy. And so the goal, it appears to be, is just get as many concessions as possible, right? And I think Trump is not someone who is wedded to particular strategies. Usually, you know, someone is guided by, I don't know, a code of ethics or certain, you know, priorities, and they prioritize one kind of strategy over another. Like, we're gonna negotiate because we want to preserve, that helps us preserve good relations, for example. But those kind of considerations don't really enter into it for him. It doesn't appear that they do. And so he's open, as you said, to all kinds of strategies, including different strategies at the same time, as long as they can contribute in some way to the United States getting concessions from others.
This is why you don't run government like a business. I mean, I've heard this my whole life, is, the government should be run like a business. Government should not be run like a business. It's a whole different animal. And running it like a business leads to this kind of chaos. I mean, not every businesses aren't typically run by a business. But if you read, you know, Donald Trump's The Art of a Deal, you'll find that that's, you know, not being truthful, pitting one person against the other. This is his whole approach. He is not the businessman we need to run our huge, lovely democracy.
Teresa writes, I wish I could believe that there will be elections or that they won't be rigged. Nothing suggests Trump will give up power. Then Brandon takes us to task and says, please stop speaking about the trappings of this stock market story. Manipulation of the markets, it's a crime, period. He and his pals made billions when he put out the DJT message to buy now. Don't let this go like it's a partisan issue. I think we have been fairly clear in the concerns about this, and mentioned the investigation that is will be underway, perhaps. Then we go to George. Hi, guys. I want you to know this. The yips, or getting yippy, is a golf term.
That's correct. If you're having trouble putting, you've got the yips.
I never heard that before.
Related to putting, Ira is exactly correct. If you have the yips, you're jerking a bit at the moment. You're striking the ball. Send your putt off course. I'm not trying to explain the president's economic strategy by any stretch, but it is instructive that he views this through the lens of golf, which leads me to my second question, says George, do we offer him a mulligan? So, very helpful on George's
which you
part.
Should explain to the uninformed.
I don't know what that means either.
Yeah, mulligan is when you hit a shot and it's lousy, so we give you another one.
So, Ray, just so you know, write this down, but when you get yippy, you're jerking a bit at the moment. Just keep that in mind. All right. Then we go to Mary Ellen for Trump: consistent behavior equals insulting and screwing our friends. He has caused incredible long-term damage. We are watching isolationism, autocracy in motion, and the rich are getting richer. And then one more letter here. There will be no stability in the world until Congress takes back the tariffs. I read that letter already, so that does not count. Kim says, my response to Trump's quick switch of tariffs amounts yesterday is that it strikes me as economic waterboarding, continuous torture of high tariffs, then the expectation of praise for the torturer when he suddenly reduces the amount of torture to lower, still unnecessary amount of tariffs. This makes our country globally untrustworthy, and for what purpose? And that is a question that I think remains an umbrella to all of this. For what purpose?
I think most people would agree that strategically placed tariffs can be an economic driver, or it can help our country restore some lines of industry that have gone away. But I'm trying to look at this as objectively as I can and say, all right, well, has he been given a more powerful strategic position by what he's done? Has the world cowered, or have they seen him blink and they realize that, you know, he may have cried wolf once too often? I mean, I do think, you know, the idea of trying to restore some kind of manufacturing, I'm not a great believer in people working in mills. I think that's a kind of an old-fashioned approach to our economic prosperity. So, again, I'm still trying to think, look in the positive and see what Rich Honan would say if he was here.
We'll have him back. We'll have him back. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have many other topics to discuss, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return with news. Well, I hope you're all having fun. Welcome back to the program, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. Malia Dumont is here, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. Welcome all. We welcome you as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Jen writes, can we reiterate that this chaos is completely invented for no reason? He loves tariffs and is a buffoon. That's why we are here. He's lawless and a grifting criminal. That will explain probably everything that happens during his entire regime. That is from The Mind of Jen on this Thursday morning. Then, let's see, also taken to task, not really taken to task, but Anna says that the yips are also a baseball term, a sudden inability to throw the ball accurately.
Yeah, I've heard it used in that context, but the golf is really where it comes from.
What did the gymnast have when it was?
That was similar. Also, I know there were a couple. There was a catcher for the Mets. I think his name was Mackie Sasser, and he couldn't throw the ball back to the pitcher. And then you had a second baseman, Steve Sachs, and another second baseman, Chuck Knobloch, who couldn't throw to first base. So that's where it was used in that context. But it's much, much more infrequent in baseball. This is more information than our listeners expected to get today.
I know, but you're on fire. Yeah. That's great.
I was going to tell you a local B.B. King story, but we'll hold and see how the rest of the show goes.
Okay, all right. You can hold it over our heads. That's fine.
The Twisties.
The Twisties, that's right. Simone Biles had the Twisties. That's exactly right. All right. So we are about to, the House is expected to vote soon on a budget vote. And this comes after House GOP leaders decided to delay a budget vote as GOP defectors were balking. After more than an hour of labored negotiations with conservative holdouts, House GOP leaders yanked their blueprint for the president's tax and spending package, lacking the votes to pass it. Speaker Johnson on Wednesday was forced to delay the vote. In a dramatic scene on Capitol Hill that laid bare Republican divisions, Mr. Johnson huddled with the holdouts in a room off the House floor for over an hour before the vote was scheduled to begin, grinding activity in the chamber to a halt as the measure's fate hung in the balance. It has been a tried-and-true tactic for Mr. Johnson, who has previously succeeded at wearing down conservative opposition on the House floor by essentially daring would-be defectors to derail planned votes on Mr. Trump's priorities. But Wednesday night was a rare instance in which the hard-right Republicans refused to blink, at least for now. And it dealt the speaker, who had confidently predicted he would have the votes to push the measure through, which was considered to be a bruising side setback to those plans. Mr. Johnson emerged from the closed-door meeting on Wednesday and told reporters that the vote on the measure would be probably tomorrow, meaning this morning, one way or the other. And we are told that they are getting ready for the vote as we speak, but I don't think we have enough information to know whether he has the votes. As he said, this vote will take place one way or the other. Does he have the votes 12 hours later? I don't know.
Hey, but the question is he really in control of the House? Is he really the Speaker of the House? Or does every time he's in a bind need to go to the President, President Trump, and have him twist some arms to get the votes he needs to pass any legislation? Because that seems to be what has happened in the past. Every time he's gotten into a squeeze, he has to reach out to the White House. And that does not bode well for the value we put on the separation of powers. In this case, the holdouts are those Republicans who are not happy whether or not this blueprint for the budget cuts enough, and they're holding firm on that. Again, I think we had a similar problem, was it last week or earlier this week, where there was a procedural issue that Mike Johnson wanted, was resisting. And again, you had to have the threat of the president, you know, like you got to have daddy get involved before the Congress people will get in line. So how much of a speaker is he? Back in the day, previous speakers have used the powers inherent in the office to negotiate, to have their own kind of power, because, you know, they get a better office, they get better committee assignments, and that's the kind of power they wield. I'm just not seeing it happen with him, and he's always afraid they're going to boot him. So in some respects, I feel a little sorry for him today. Let's hope he's counted well.
get that out of your head right
now. Let's hope he's counted well before they start taking this vote. Usually they know what the votes are before they start taking them. But again, it's Thursday. That's the end of the week. They got to go home tonight.
Well, even if he's counted correctly and he's counted – in such a way as it reflects poorly on him. I think he feels it's important that, that at some point it's important to make public who specifically is blocking the legislation. I mean, I'm certainly no fan of Johnson, but and maybe my memory is bad on this, but he has the disadvantage of having a handful of dissidents in a tightly drawn Congress. In other words, if he had more of a cushion, the 8 or 10 dissidents could go yabber as much as you want. It's not going to make any difference. We can pass the bill without you. And now they can't. They need to get these guys with them. And it's a difficult position. I think I saw a clip of Newt Gingrich the other day saying that when Newt Gingrich was the speaker, he was on offense all the time, and Johnson has to play defense.
See, Ira feels sorry for him, too. Not just me. You feel sorry for Johnson, too, right?
In this particular case, yes. I don't feel sorry for any of these guys. I often feel a pox on both their houses is where I come down on this, but that's another story.
I think Johnson has lasted in this position a lot longer than many people predicted, and he's figured out a strategy that has worked for him. And I think Judy laid it out pretty well. He is Trump's speaker, and he's using some of the same tactics to try to keep his fellow Republicans in line.
I've said my piece.
All right. Then I thought
we'll have a similar.
I thought that more was coming. Yes. I apologize.
We'll have a similar discussion in a few months when we start talking about the debt limit again.
Well, right. And we'll also, as Malia pointed out a minute ago, we don't know how long the vote will take or whether even it's officially underway or not. They were meeting in the chamber, but I don't know where they are in that as we speak. All right, let's move on to other topics. And again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We go to the story on Kash Patel and dropped from the role of ATF and replaced with an Army secretary. This is an interesting story because of how quiet it was, and also interesting story because the reason that many are giving that why he was removed is because he just never showed up, and that he hadn't been in the building. They asked him for his bio to put on the website, and nothing was ever done, and so. They removed FBI Director Kash Patel as the interim head of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives, replacing him with the Secretary of the Army, which would be Dan Driscoll. Driscoll will simultaneously hold both the top roles at ATF and the Army. It's an unusual setup that Patel also had, serving as both the FBI Director and the acting ATF Director. The Justice Department oversees ATF. The people familiar with the adjustments said that they were not informed about why the Trump administration made the change when announcing the leadership shakeup to ATF officials on Wednesday. The Justice Department said Patel had actually been removed as ATF director a few days after he was sworn in the position in late February, they think, according to a person familiar with the briefing. Senior ATF leadership had not been informed that Patel was removed, according to multiple people familiar with the operations of the agency. The ATF issued a news release on Tuesday about a policy change that quoted Patel as the agency's acting director. That just hours before the news came out that he was not the acting director and had not been since February. The White House did not address when Patel stepped down or say who has been leading the ATF since late February, if it was not Kash Patel. A spokesman described Patel's stint at ATF as, quote, brief.
Why do we need acting directors? Trump has certainly not been hesitant to nominate people. He seemed to be very well organized and got out of the gate real quickly. I'm at a loss for, I mean, Patel, has so much baggage. Most people believe that it's a race between Patel and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as to who were the worst or least qualified cabinet members. But
gotta put Hegseth in there too.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. Forgot about him.
Yeah.
But I don't understand why we're talking about acting directors.
There are a couple. I find this very odd for a number of reasons. One, there have to be a lot of other people within this agency who could step up and be the acting director. So why reach across to a completely different cabinet department, federal agency, and bring someone in who, by the way, has a pretty busy job leading the largest army? You know, I mean, that's very strange to me. Like, why? And what does it say about Trump's relationship with Dan Driscoll? Dan Driscoll is an Army veteran who also went to Yale Law School and did a lot of work supporting veterans, like legal work for veterans, but was kind of a surprise pick for Secretary of the Army. He's relatively young. But I also think there are some sort of indirect constitutional implications here, because the Army is, although obviously it's raised, it's trained, and it's of the American people, it's largely, for a lot of good reasons, written into our Constitution, not used inside the United States. The exception is the National Guard, because the National Guard can work in a state status, and that's when they're helping with disaster relief, et cetera, and they can also be federalized for overseas operations. But the Army is an international force. The FBI, ATF, those are they have more of a domestic mission, and so like the weird overlaps and also you know, firewalls that exist between some of these agencies and some of their missions, it's very complicated, and I don't fully understand how it's implicated by this change, but it's a very odd thing to have someone, the civilian Secretary of the Army, serving in this ATF role as well.
As it was for Kash Patel to be serving in that role.
Yeah, but I think the FBI and ATF work together in a lot of ways already, and so like that relationship already exists. There are statutory divisions that are meant to help safeguard the civil liberties of Americans that keep the federal military forces in their own sort of, you know, in their own bubble, in a way, and that's not connected to civilian agencies like the ATF.
But to Ira's point, and I think it's a good one, which is, you know, we have people. There's people there, right?
And that's why couldn't
so
one of them be raised up
and
acting?
And to try to answer my own question, I'm wondering if this was an area where they were trying to consolidate to save money. That's the only other. But if the only savings would be at the top, it's not that big a deal. If it was a broad brush to combine the two departments, that's something else. But I don't think it's that. As Jeffrey Rush said in Shakespeare in Love, it's a mystery.
Yeah, absent a clear explanation from my government, which I think people have a right to get, you'd have to assume that they're trying to remake the ATF into a more military-oriented organization. And if they're going to do that, they really need to tell us that. There's talk that they may want to weaponize the ATF to do more in terms of immigration control and enforcement. So something's happening here. It's not, you know, or something is happening, or they would have just promoted someone from within, or left Kash Patel there. They did this on purpose. They don't always do things on purpose or with a overarching strategy, but I think in this case they did, and time is going to tell. I think they have an obligation to tell us, but they're not going to. And we have to rely on reporters to dig this one out for us.
And as far as the reporters digging this out, I mean, ultimately, if someone is say, okay, you're going to be a placeholder, and then they just don't do anything, and then nobody bothers to tell anybody, they sort of forget. I don't know how much there is, right? I mean, it just seems like
The public
poor attendance.
I mean, one of the things we're finding in this administration is the communications. You know, the people who serve as government employees to provide communications to the public, those are among the people most often gutted or removed from power. People who are supposed to be charged with filling out freedom or complying with the freedom of information laws. A lot of those people are gone. So it's not a transparent administration. You know, most administrations aren't, to be quite honest. Government typically doesn't like to tell the public everything they do, and some things they don't have to tell us, but if they'd be more forthcoming, we'd all be better off.
All right, let's go to, let me see here.
Just to point out, the FBI and ATF both fall under the larger umbrella of the DOJ, and they're overseen. Oversight is provided by the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee. And so if ATF is somehow being in some stealthy way, this is some way to try to append it to the Department of Defense, that is an enormous change. And I don't think we've seen, even in the midst of all these mass firings and whatever, that's downsizing agencies. Even when Trump said that student loan servicing was going to move from DOE to the Small Business Administration, that's moving a function from one agency to another. But to move an entire federal agency from one cabinet department to another, that is a much larger order of magnitude in some ways move than some of the other, even these huge federal firings. I think it's we haven't seen something like this yet, of trying to move something from one cabinet agency to another. It implicates Congress in ways that some of Trump's other decisions haven't. I'll be very interested to see if, for example, the House Judiciary Committee has anything to say about this.
Now, my understanding, I read an article last night that another possibility in this was the disinterest that the administration had in the ATF, and perhaps a thought that, like the Education Department, they would just dissolve it. So that this would give them the opportunity to let it fade away,
right, as it were. Yeah.
And meanwhile, they gave the initial assignment to Kash Patel, whose original charge was to do something with the FBI, and what exactly that it means, nobody knows. But Trump certainly wanted an overhaul of the FBI, and they bring in Patel, who likely is not even qualified to be there, but he's in charge of captaining that effort. And then on top of that, you're giving him this other thing to do. So no wonder he didn't pay attention to the ATF.
This from just 1 minute ago, but House Speaker Mike Johnson says he does have the votes to pass the budget plan. This is just, if you're just joining us, a day after he was forced to delay a vote on the Republican budget blueprint. That blueprint the vote is expected at any moment. It is underway. As we speak, as I see activity on the House floor and the monitor above our heads, so that is what Johnson is saying. So I assume that he, you assume he knows, right?
Assume he can count,
right? So that would be something that we'll find out. And also interesting, I think, to figure out exactly what was said to hardline conservatives that had balked about this that made them change their mind. And as I said earlier in the description of this, that is something that Johnson has become quite good at of making that case. So we will find out more coming up.
Can I just to close the loop on what we were just talking about.
So
just to point out, the ATF is a law enforcement agency, and by constitution, the U.S. military does not have a law enforcement function. But it also, looping this back to connection with the tariff issue, the ATF has a huge role in partnering with the DEA on stopping fentanyl traffickers, because there's enormous overlap. Criminal organizations who traffic narcotics often traffic in illegal arms as well. And so that's the kind of work that the ATF has done. And it does make no sense at all if fentanyl is one of the key reasons that's being cited for why the United States needs to have tariffs on China, and yet we're trying to stealthily make the ATF, which is one of the key agencies involved in trying to prosecute, like track down and prosecute fentanyl and traffickers, like these actions go against each other.
I'm not looking to create problems here.
Okay.
I just want to read one of my favorite lines that came in the news coverage. It's just one sentence, and it's out of context. I'll admit it's out of context, but I don't know what the context is. But it was a quote from Kash Patel, and he said, he said at his last public appearance at a UFC match.
That was Patel's last appearance.
Yes. Yeah. So
there's a metaphor there.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems interesting, doesn't it? That would be the last public appearance.
Do our listeners know what UFC is?
Ultimate Fighting or something?
Championship?
Yeah. Competition.
Isn't that where they get in the like cage matches?
Yeah.
They get yippee at UFC matches.
Yeah, it's another sign of the decline of civility.
That's right. Well, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll wrap up our time together with the group, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we certainly look forward. When we come back, we're going to talk about a very important story about showerheads. And so one of the executive orders yesterday had to do with showerheads. And we'll talk about that when we return after this. Just got a little message on my watch, and it says activity, but it says Joe, you're off to a great start today.
Does it really?
Yeah.
How nice.
And I don't feel that way, but I'm glad that my watch has noticed it. That's very nice.
Is that coming from the watch or from the listeners?
No, that's coming from the watch.
Oh
the listeners certainly don't think I'm doing it.
When I'm driving, sometimes I get a message on the dashboard saying, you've been driving a long time. Do you want to pull over and get a cup of coffee?
Yes, I've had that. I've had that, too. Yeah. I wish my watch didn't tell me about when I go into AFib or that my heart rate is high, but it does, and you feel weird. It's like, oh, okay, now what do I do? So we're talking about the president has signed an executive order to make America's showers great again. In an executive order, the president directed the Energy Department to rescind a rule limiting water flow in shower heads. The executive order was signed Wednesday, lifting restrictions on how much water can be used by shower heads, saying his administration would make showers great again. This is not The Onion. This is not the Borowitz report. This is real life. The order underscored how Trump remains fixated on one of his favorite targets, more efficient shower heads that he has blamed for ruining his, quote, perfect hair, even in the midst of global upheaval caused by his turbulent tariff policies. This from the Washington Post. I like to take a nice shower to take care of my beautiful hair, Trump said at the signing of the order at the White House. I have to stand in the shower for 15 minutes until it gets wet. It's ridiculous.
No exaggeration.
In a fact sheet sent to reporters, and fact sheet is in italics in this article, the White House said the order, quote, frees Americans from excessive regulations that turned a basic household item into a bureaucratic nightmare, adding that Trump would end the Obama-Biden war on water pressure and make America's showers great once again. The order, first reported by the Wall Street Journal, directs the Energy Department to rescind a regulation issued under Barack Obama and later reinstated by President Joe Biden. The rule limited the flow from each showerhead on the market to 2.5 gallons of water per minute. During Trump's first term, the Energy Department introduced what efficiency experts called a loophole to this rule. The agency dictated that for showerheads with more than one nozzle, the limit applied to the flow for each nozzle rather than the entire fixture. Yet manufacturers of showerheads are not clamoring for another rollback. Few manufacturers offer fixtures that fall under the definition from Trump's first term, according to the Appliance Standards Awareness Project. Yes, such a thing exists. In its own fact sheet, the Appliance Standards Awareness Project argued that the stricter standards would save consumers money on their water and energy bills without sacrificing a nice experience in the shower. There were some lousy shower heads back in the 90s, but today, review after review finds there are countless models that provide a great drenching, according to Andrew Dulaski, the group's executive director, saying in a statement Wednesday in this report from the Washington Post. Trump has long targeted efficiency standards for showerheads, toilets, dishwashers, and other household appliances, frequently criticizing them during his first campaign and his first term. So showerheads, you take a shower, the water doesn't come out, Trump said at the White House. You want to wash your hands, the water doesn't come out. So what do? You just stand there longer or you take a shower longer because my hair, I know about you. But it, or I don't know about you, but it has to be perfect. Perfect.
Sounds like a cold open for Saturday Night Live.
It does.
Right,
yeah.
It writes itself.
Yeah, those guys are lucky, you know, with the Trump administration, all the late night comedy guys. You know, he has talked about the problem. He did spend a lot of time on low flow toilets, too, during. And he would talk about, and you know, flushing again and again to get the job done.
I would just like to say that for the last 20, maybe even 30 years, that humorist Dave Barry has said in his column that he was going to run for president, and his only campaign issue was going to be low flow toilets, and it was a joke. And it was a joke that went on for a really long time. And he would go places and they would pay him money to make speeches where he would be a presidential candidate and talk about a low-flow toilet and said that it would take you 75 times to flush an olive.
That Dave Barry, gotta love him.
But that, this is not a joke.
Well, and if Judith Henk was here, she would tell us that there's a reason for this, is trying to reduce water consumption. Water is a valuable resource. I can't help but think, I just finished watching this streaming show, The Residence, and it's about a murder in the White House.
Yeah.
And the president in this one has this obsession with high pressure, really hot shower in the White House. It was just like, you know, I was watching this and I go, oh my God, this is just like our very own president. Trump. It's an obsession that is treated in the show as strange, weird, and something that beyond the normal.
I'm befuddled by how, as he says, it takes 15 minutes for him to get his hair wet.
Because I'm imagining so many reasons for it. But do you remember that movie, The Truman Show?
Yes.
This story just makes me feel like we're all sort of like stuck in the Truman Show. And this is like, there's a scene in the movie where Laura Linney, who Truman thinks is his wife, but she's actually an actress acting as his wife. And she's doing like this product placement, telling him like, drink this beautiful cocoa. It's so delicious. Yeah. And now we're like, we're listening to this. I mean, aliens out there are watching us. We're like, we're their entertainment. That's what I feel like right now. But there's a couple things. One, mechanical engineers, I'm sure, could come up with some really interesting ways. I mean, water pressure is not only a function of volume of water, right? You could design shower heads so that it like lower flow water can produce the same kind of water pressure. So that sounds like a mechanical challenge that I'm sure a lot of smart people could come up with some solutions to. there's two things here that I think fall in line with Trump's approach to a lot of policies. One, it connects back to something that's a very personal experience for him. In this case, taking a shower,
which no one wants to think about.
No one wants to think about. Yeah, and then two, it's no environmental regulation is too small for him to try to undo it.
Well, and doesn't this get into the for those who say that much of what he does is king-like, that as ruler of the free world, you can say, okay, I'm going to change shower heads.
And let me just also point out that the fastest growing state in our country is Arizona, whose largest city, Phoenix, famously has several growing suburbs that have no water. Like, people have to truck water because it's in the middle of a desert. And this is not the time to be acting like water is an
plentiful,
infinite resource.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So I did wonder about whether we should include the story or not. But I thought it was, it's funny, but also that it is, I mean, you know, as anything in this is funny, but
we have to find our humor where we can.
That's right. But also that something like this is being taken seriously. There are just a barrage of other things that are not being taken seriously at all, which I think was the ultimate point I was hoping to make.
Did he do this on this topsy-turvy roller coaster tariff day?
It was right after the tariffs, and then he invited everyone in, and they were asking him questions, and as he was doing it, there's that person who hands him the binder and says, this executive order does this, 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 and this. And then one of them was on the... showerheads.
Who knows how many more executive orders he's got.
Well, you know,
you
watch him when he has those quote-unquote ceremonies. It's funny when he will sign it and hear the summary and he'll say, oh, that's a good one. You know, keep your hand near the button, Joe. But I just wonder if Trump is interested in showers for the same reason that it's been rumored that he has issues with Russia, and that's why Putin's got him in his pocket. I'm a little careful. How
no,
wording
I understand.
Is. Okay.
I think we're picking up what you're putting down,
okay,
as it were. We have a minute and a half. Do you have time to tell your BB King story?
Oh, I can do it a lot. BB King was playing UPAC in Kingston, and the show was delayed because they had, I guess, two tour buses, one of which had carried Lucille,
the guitar. Famous guitar.
Yeah, and Lucille was lost. So the city of Kingston, they were able to track the bus or wherever it was. And Lucille got a police escort to the show.
That's very nice.
Yes.
I once went to go see Robert Klein and Chuck Berry at the Valley Forge Music Fair in the mid-'80s. And Chuck Berry never came out because he was arrested for tax evasion backstage, to which Robert Klein came on and did a two-hour act basically on nothing other than...
He's one of the greats.
Absolutely. My thanks to everybody this morning. I appreciate you all being here, and thank you very much. Renee says, when your hair is so damaged from chemical treatment, it feels gummy and you never feel like it's thoroughly wet. That is Renee's thought on this, by the way. I'll throw that in as a bon mot. We'll be back with more show. Thank you all. Be well. We'll be back right after this.